Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Today, we welcome on our show Dr. Laura Olson, a professor of political science at Clemson University, who not only grew up in Wisconsin, but also earned her doctorate from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, or the other UW, as I like to say. Professor Olson specializes in the study of contemporary religion, civic engagement, and American politics, and has placed special emphasis on the political attitudes and behaviors of the clergy. Her work has appeared in leading scholarly journals, including Political Research Quarterly, Social Science Quarterly, and the Journal for the Scientific Study of Religion. Laura is the author, co-author, or co-editor of 9 books, including Religion and Politics in America, Faith, Culture, and Strategic Choices, Beyond Red State, Blue State, Electoral Gaps in the 21st Century American Electorate, Religious Interest in Community Conflict Beyond the Culture Wars, and Women with a Mission, Religion, Gender, and the Politics of Women Clergy, to name just a few of those 9 books. A frequent source for expertise for various media outlets, Professor Olson has been interviewed by CNN, National Public Radio, and BBC Radio, as well as being quoted in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the Washington Post, and USA Today. And now can add to that list Research on Religion podcast, certainly the gravy on top of what is all that media meatloaf. Dr. Olson also won Clemson University's campus-wide Fleur Daniel Student Government Excellence in Teaching Award back in 2003. More information about Professor Olson can be found over at our website, including links to her 9 books, so please check all of that out. You will not be disappointed. Laura, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you so much, Tony. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you have quite the scholarly resume, being the prolific writer that you are, and we've been trying to get you on the podcast for a while here. I'm glad you made some time for it. Your interests are really interesting, especially around campaign season here, and you also have some broad interests, so you're the person that we want to be talking to you in the fall. And if we get a chance near the end of our podcast today, we might pick your brain as to how religion has played out in recent presidential elections and how you think it might be playing a role in the current campaign for the Oval Office. But today we want to look more specifically at an area of your research that might not get as much splash in the national media, but what I think is still very important and interesting. And that's the role of religious free exercise in the classroom. And you recently presented a paper about this at the American Political Science Association's annual conference, along with a number of your co-researchers. So first off, why don't you give a big shout out to all your co-authors out there?
Sounds good. I have quite a few, actually, and there are people who are involved in the project besides our respondents to the survey who aren't named, and those are undergraduate students here at Clemson. But Danny Frost is my colleague in political science, and he primarily studies constitutional law in the United States. Suzanne Rosenblith is professor and chair in the School of Education here at Clemson, and she and I have been personal friends for a long time and had been hoping to find a way to work together, and this has given us that opportunity. Will McCorkle is Suzanne's graduate student in the School of Ed and is wonderful and has been helping in so many important ways with a bunch of logistics with regard to the project. And Ben Bindewald is a professor of education at Oklahoma State University, and he was a graduate student of Suzanne's and mine, and we're very proud of him for getting the great job that he has, and we're including him on this project as it moves forward. So
Yeah, I should note that the paper that we're working off of has a working title called Teacher Attitudes About the Limits of Religious Free Exercise in the Classroom, and it has it's noted as a work in progress here, so we're just going to kind of be talking about some of your initial findings here, but an interesting piece nonetheless, and I think will be published in the near future because it has a lot of implications for public policy, and we'll be exploring those. One of the questions I had was how you got connected with these folks in the education department, but it seems like you answered that Suzanne Rosenblith is just a personal friend. Were you hanging out at a coffee shop at some point in time and say, hey, you know, we're like Paul McCartney and Mick Jagger, let's kind of do an album together or something?
More or less, yes, actually. So she and I have been personal friends for a long time. We actually play in the same fantasy football league. So, you know, fantasy football can lead to all kinds of scholarly productivity, it turns out.
Yep.
But Suzanne and I, two summers ago, we were hanging out, having dinner, actually, at her place. And she was kind of saying to me that, you know, watching the Hobby Lobby decision and then the Obergefell decision. Actually, this would have been one summer ago, not two. But anyhow, she's explaining to me that, she's been noticing the sort of change in the courts, the thinking perhaps about religious free exercise. And I added to that, in the context of these important court cases from the last two summers, that the idea of religious free exercise, indeed, just as a general concept in American politics, seems to be being redefined. And instead of thinking about religious free exercise as something that we need to protect just for religious minority groups, instead has very recently become a concept that people who are in the religious majority, i.e. the Judeo-Christian majority, seem to be thinking about in their own regard. And on that point, I think that the Catholic bishops' reaction to the so-called birth control mandate under the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, their sort of push to assert Catholic free exercise rights around being skeptical or being exclusive about birth control, sort of being exclusionary really about birth control, sort of has prompted more people in religious majority groups to think, maybe my personal religious right, or my religious right to exercise the beliefs that I hold could be being violated. And so what that led to is us thinking, especially since Suzanne studies teachers, studies education, led to us thinking, especially once Kim Davis, the county clerk in Kentucky, after Obergefell, refused to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples and thus was not doing her job, we wondered, what if a teacher in a public school setting were to do something similar? And sort of asked, could it be the case that there might be a teacher or some subset of teachers out there who might want to follow the lead that Kim Davis sort of created in her actions around same-sex couples who wanted to get married in Kentucky? So I pretty quickly said, you know, I think this is an empirical question to try and find out what teachers think in the aggregate. And that led us to decide to not just do a project together, but to write a survey and send it out to a whole bunch of teachers all across the U.S. and gather some empirical data to try and find out a little bit more about what teachers think would be an acceptable means of religious free exercise in the classroom as opposed to more unacceptable means.
This is a very ambitious project, and you're also finding a niche here in the public schools that it hasn't really quite touched upon the free or in the public schools yet, but it is going to. Step back a moment, though, and help us set the table for listeners who might not be all that familiar with some of the cases that you mentioned, the Obergefell case and the Hobby Lobby case. We have had a podcast on Hobby Lobby, and we'll point folks back to that. But this whole general area of religious free exercise, set the table for us. And what is the context of American politics and religion and politics that this is all operating in?
Absolutely. So the Constitution, actually the First Amendment, includes the language, starts frankly with the language, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Doesn't say anything in terms of specific words about separation between church and state, but instead, those are the words it gives us. And so over many years, the Supreme Court has had to interpret, particularly since the middle part of the 20th century, has had to interpret actions that a government might take, whether it's the federal government, state government, a local government might take, that could be construed as preferring one religion over another. And that's what we mean by establishment. So no level of government, for reasons that we probably don't have time to explain right now, but no level of government is allowed to do something, take some action, enforce some policy that might allow someone to look and say, oh, aha, they're preferring Christianity, or they're preferring Islam, or they're preferring Presbyterianism, or whatever the case might be. Then separately, no level of government can tell me or you or anyone that we cannot do what we need to do to practice the religion that we sincerely believe. Now, there are limits to that, and there are, you know, kind of, am I allowed to go murder somebody because my religion told me that I have to? Well, no. But since 1990, there's been, around free exercise in particular, a great deal of controversy because, long story short, the Supreme Court in 1990 changed the way that they had thought about interpreting what the limits of free exercise should look like. And that made a lot of people angry. And so laws have been passed over a period of 22 years and continue to be passed that are designed to protect and guarantee to the greatest extent possible an individual's right to practice in whatever way they need to the religion that they sincerely believe. And then separately, around establishment, the idea is that free exercise, you can practice the religion that you want to practice, but establishment, government cannot do anything that could be construed as preference between or among religions. So as far as it goes with teachers, it's been the case since 1947 that teachers have been sort of assumed to be agents of the state in public schools, I should clarify, in public schools. Teachers are seen as agents of the state, or that is the government, and therefore anything that a teacher might do that could be construed as preferring one religion over another pretty quickly would be shut down, at least on paper, at least in principle. And I can tell you more about that if you think the listeners would be interested. On the free exercise side, though, since the Catholic bishops have been articulating that, hey, you know, if we are forced to dispense birth control because of a federal law, that's actually a violation of our religious free exercise rights, because we're being told that something we need to not do in this case, we have to do. So that's a violation of our free exercise rights. Then meanwhile, in the Hobby Lobby case, which, as you say, you've already talked about on this podcast, but in a sentence, what the Hobby Lobby decision does is the Supreme Court sort of interprets Hobby Lobby, which is, of course, a corporation that's closely held by one family, and that one family has very specific and rather orthodox religious beliefs, and they did not want to provide certain forms of birth control to people who work for Hobby Lobby. Supreme Court found for Hobby Lobby, suggesting that your right, or even a corporation, in this case kind of a family, but through a corporation's organization, ought not to be told that you have to do X, Y, or Z, or that you can't do X, Y, or Z, because we need to protect your religious liberty. Then, along comes last summer, Obergefell versus Hodges, in which the Supreme Court, and I'm sure all the listeners know about this case, even if you don't know the name of it, Obergefell is the case in which the Supreme Court says that across all 50 states, same-sex marriage has to be legal and has to be observed. So what happened is, of course, some people liked that and others didn't. One person who didn't is this woman whose name is Kim Davis, who I believe no longer is, but at least was last summer. No, it would have been two summers, whatever it was, mm-hmm. 2 summers ago. I don't know if this summer's over or not. I think that's my problem. Anyway, Kim Davis said, well, I am a devout Christian, and I disagree with the concept of people of the same gender getting married. And so happens that my job is I'm a county clerk, and I issue marriage licenses. And so same-sex couples would, in Rowan County, Kentucky, where Kim Davis worked, come in and say, we want to get married. Supreme Court says we can get married. And she would say, no, you know, I have decided that I am not going to do my job, and I am not going to issue this marriage certificate to, or marriage license to you. And then that kind of attracted all kinds of media attention, and that's died down now. But Suzanne and I, in particular, were wondering, like I said before, maybe it's the case that a teacher out there might look at this logic, right, might look at this change in how Americans in general, and certainly the political class, and to a certain degree the legal class, have been interpreting religious free exercise. And a public school teacher might say, hey, you know, there's any number of things that I, as an individual, ought to be allowed to do, regardless of my status as an agent of the state during school time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one can see how the two clauses of the First Amendment kind of come into conflict here if you're a state employee or if you're a school teacher. One of the things that I like about your study is that it's very forward thinking. You're anticipating a potential problem and doing some survey work on it before it really becomes a major issue. We haven't seen it play out that much in schools. Have we? Have there been any instances where you have a Kim Davis-like incident in a public school?
Nothing too much. There was a case in Oregon, I believe, where a teacher wanted to be allowed to wear traditional Sikh religious dress. That caused some uproar. And in Dearborn, Michigan, where there's a substantial population of Muslim people, the public schools agreed to let boys and girls have separate swimming classes because to see one another, to see the opposite gender in a swimming suit for many really strict Muslims isn't something that you would do. So there have been a few little kind of possible little embers, I guess, here and there, but by and large, no, nothing much has happened yet.
Yeah, so that, I mean, it creates an interesting thing, and it's interesting to then think about, okay, what are people in these situations thinking about? I mean, are they even thinking about it at all? And so that is what you are going to do. You bring all these folks together. You and Suzanne are talking about this over dinner and said, hey, let's do a project. Let's get into the project a little bit and understand the technical details and the rationale of it. But one of the questions that I have, and I'm always impressed by people who can do this, you can do this much, much better than I, is to bring all these people together. Not only the five authors working on this thing, but you have undergraduates and stuff. How do you do that? How do you get all these folks involved in
We are really actually very fortunate at Clemson. We have a program here that is called Creative Inquiry, and a provost of ours a couple years back or several years back thought, you know, wouldn't it be a nice thing if students, not just in the hard sciences, but across disciplines, could have the opportunity to work together with faculty on research. And of course, like any idea, it had its bumps along the way. But what's ended up happening for us is we can allow students to sign up for some, academic credits and then involve them in our research, assuming that you have a project that would work well that way. So what we've done, we're in our third semester now, is we have gone and we have recruited students in the School of Ed and in political science and in religious studies, and I think we've asked around in social and psych too, for anybody who has any interest in these kinds of matters. And so what we've done is we've been lucky to find about 10, 12 or so students per semester who have been willing to help pitch in and work on, frankly, a lot of the real nitty-gritty kind of, you know, elbows deep in the dirt kind of details of getting this project launched. And we would not be where we are if it were not for this awesome team of undergrads who have helped us and continue to help. So,
yeah, as we dig down into the methodological aspects of the study, which I always find as fascinating, there is just a lot of this nitty-gritty detail stuff. And you know, to have 10 or 12 undergraduates working on this project each semester, wow, that's pretty impressive that you can manage that all. For me, that would be like herding cats. I'm kind of a lone wolf.
It kind of is. It can be. But yeah. To the degree that, I mean, and it like with their schedules and everything, yeah. Trying to find times that we can all get together is tough, blah, blah, blah. But what we've done is we have found ways of breaking up the job into bite-sized pieces and assigning pieces to students. So what we did, what we've done to this point, and we're literally almost done, is we drew a sample of teachers, and I can explain how we did that if you think folks would like to hear. But we drew a big sample of public school teachers across the U.S., and it turns out, and many teachers turned out not to know this, but public school teachers' email addresses are a matter of public record. And so all it takes is a little bit of online detective work to find teacher email addresses. And we implemented our survey over the internet. So the students, last year in particular, did a little bit at a time, like different students would be assigned to different school districts and even schools, to track down the email addresses of classroom teachers who had made their way into our survey, into our sampling frame. So without them doing that work, I don't know where we would be. We wouldn't have done any of this probably.
I know. It's so time consuming that you're like, oh, why should we do this study? But you have done it. And that is kind of cool. And to remind folks again that the title of the paper is Teacher Attitudes About the Limits of Religious Free Exercise in the Classroom. And give us kind of the broad picture of what you're trying to find. You're trying to find attitudes about the limits of religious free exercise. And I was kind of curious when I read that title. I said, well, why the limits of free exercise and not a different word like the opportunities of free exercise?
Right. That's actually a really good question. Really good question. I think that the reason why you'd think I'd say, I know that the reason why, but you know, sometimes in academia, you're not sure. The reason why for now we've used that term, the limits of, is because one of the major things that's driving us intellectually is this question of, is there a line, right, even if it's like kind of a winding or dotted line between actions that might potentially be acceptable on the part of teachers and actions that might not be. And then your next question might be acceptable to whom, right? Acceptable to society, acceptable to parents, acceptable to students, acceptable to school boards and principals. Well, you know, we thought that we'd go to the source and ask teachers what they thought would be acceptable on the part of other teachers. So this was kind of a strategic decision that we made. We're actually, I can reveal this is brand new. We are just starting to see about extending our survey, or not our survey, but our study, to include a new survey of the state legislators and school board members that correspond to the schools that we sampled from, to be able to see what people in a more public official kind of capacity, a more obviously public official kind of capacity, think about these kinds of questions. But really what is driving us is sort of this generic interest or concern about, would it be okay to do X but not okay to do Y? Mm-hmm. And if so, what would predict an attitude that, yeah, it's okay to wear a cross around my neck. It is not okay for me to decide that we're going to lead the students in prayer at the beginning of the class, day in the classroom, and invoke the name of Jesus, right? Or so what would be okay and what wouldn't be? So the survey goes through quite a bit of, quite a few different ways of asking that question, frankly.
Yeah, and talk about that in terms of, without the details of the nitty-gritty details of the survey, but you had five areas of interest that you were looking at or trying to probe in that. Give us an idea what those five areas are.
Yes. So the first is, should teachers be able, agree or disagree, basically, teachers should be able to opt out of certain professional responsibilities because of religious beliefs. And we didn't get specific there, just sort of the general question of, you know, do you think it would be okay for a teacher, hypothetical teacher, to do this or not? The second one is the same thing asked in a little bit different way, which is, if a teacher feels the need to exercise his or her religious beliefs through some kind of action, should they be allowed to do so without facing any potential workplace penalty? So it's one thing to say in general, yeah, I think that would be okay. It's another to put it in a context, we think, of that you might, you should not have to face kind of negative repercussions for doing so. The third one, and this is one of my favorite questions on the entire survey, we asked the teachers whether or not they would support a public official. And we did not name Kim Davis, but we said, would you, you know, to what degree would you support a public official who refused to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples in the case that the Supreme Court of the United States said that same-sex marriage ought to be legal across the land. So it's a long, kind of long-winded question that doesn't name Kim Davis, but is basically asking whether or not they would support someone, i.e. Kim Davis, doing what she did.
Yeah, and that's a cool question. I got to stop you right there. I like that cool question because that does force somebody into that situation saying, oh, what if that was me on that day, right? That's a cool question.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm very excited about this question, actually. And it does. I mean, it puts you in that hypothetical situation, which is kind of a neat thing that a lot of surveys, I think, don't often do. Then the last two items that we looked at were measures. They're kind of detailed measures of, first of all, the degree to which the teacher filling out the survey supports teachers being permitted to do specific religiously oriented activities on the job. And there's a bunch of them that we added together. And then finally, the degree to which teachers support the notion of teachers, other teachers, saying, I'm going to provide you with some clear moral direction about controversial issues in class, whether religious or political issues. So those were the five, and there's lots more material, of course, in our survey, but for our first preliminary analysis, these are the questions that I decided to pull out.
Okay. So you did a sample of public school teachers. We learned that their emails are up there on the World Wide Web for everybody to see. Tell us a little bit more about drafting up the questionnaire, how you had to be thinking about the type of questions that you're asked, and then also give us some idea what the response rate is. That's always a big issue when you're doing surveys, because it could be a lot of people who are really jazzed up about this issue answer, but people who aren't really that concerned about it don't, and that might skew the sample or something. So give us an idea of what the procedures were here and the potential biases that might have been affecting it and how you dealt with that.
Absolutely. So in terms of writing survey, we worked really hard on the questions that that get at the matter that we're really sort of trying to analyze here, and that would be the free exercise, the limits of free exercise questions. And we worked, actually, we involved the students in this, and we went through draft after draft after draft, because previous studies haven't really looked at this sort of thing very much. And when that's the case, you're kind of, you are the one who has to write the survey question because nobody's done it for you before. We also, we sort of pre-tested our survey with some School of Ed grad students here at Clemson last year who gave us some really good feedback about what was clear, what wasn't clear, this kind of thing. Apart from that, in every context that we could, we used question wording that that we took directly from previously conducted studies. So, for example, trying to determine what the teacher's religious affiliation is a lot more difficult matter than many listeners might realize. Like, for example, if you're a Presbyterian, well, what kind of Presbyterian are you? And does that matter? Well, yeah, it actually does. And this sort of thing. So we used what I would say is sort of the gold standard series of questions to determine religious affiliation. Or party identification, political ideology, things like this. Folks have worked over many decades to decide exactly how these kinds of things should be asked, and so we used wording that we know has been used to good effect in previous surveys. So we were aiming to get a really big sample size when we are done. And we're going to end up with over 4,000 cases, which is incredibly exciting. And one of the reasons why we wanted to get such a big sample size is because we had so much stuff that we wanted to ask these teachers, but we also didn't want to take up more than 15 or so minutes of their time. So what we decided to do was break the survey up into two parts. There's a core part that everybody did. Those were the questions that we decided were most important. We have to know this from everybody, like political ideology, party ID, religious affiliation, answers to the big important religious freedom questions, demographic information, this sort of thing. But then we also had we had a separate half of the survey which rotated. So every fourth respondent got the same second half of the survey, every second respondent got a different one, etc. So there are 1,000, we hope, or so individuals who have completed each of those additional sets of questions. So that's going to enable, we think, a lot more analysis than otherwise would have been the case. You also asked about our response rate. I don't have that calculated just yet because we are just finishing up. But I'm not going to lie to you and tell you it's really high. It's not. It's low. But what are we going to do? We're going to have to explain that somehow. We're going to have to justify it somehow. One challenge for us was that people don't like to click on links in emails that they don't know, you know, is it spam, is it this, that, or the other. So I fielded emails. In our survey, the invitation went out, it said, if you have questions, contact Laura Olson at Clemson University. So here and there, I'd say maybe 100 people emailed me over the course of this year to say, so is this legitimate? How did you pick me? This and that. And I'm scared to click the link. I just want to make sure you're a real person, this sort of thing. But not everybody would have gone to the length of contacting me because it takes time. Another challenge for us has been some schools and school districts have very, very high spam walls on their email servers or whatever. And so systematically we had really super low response rates from some schools. So we're going to take a look at whether or not maybe we ought not to include, maybe we ought to just simply pull that school or that school district from our sample. But, you know, I hope we're around 10%, which isn't great, but hopefully people won't. And we can take a look and see. If I had to guess, we've oversampled high school teachers as compared with teachers in lower grades. If I had to guess, maybe we've oversampled on women a little bit more than men, but I haven't seen all the final numbers yet, so I wouldn't want to say something and have it end up being completely the opposite. Yeah.
But maybe we ask that because I think a lot of people out there, they see surveys in the news and they go, oh, this seems like a pretty easy task to get this all right. You just call up somebody and you ask them a bunch of questions and they tell you stuff and you report it. But there's a lot of work behind the scenes that go into this. And you know, a lot of people don't answer surveys anymore. So people who say, well, the survey is, you know, just pretty easy to do. And I go, well, do you ever answer these things? Oh, no, I never do. I'm like, well, you know, we got to find the people who don't and try to get them to answer, which is always a challenge. You could call me, though. I'd love answering surveys. I get a survey, I love to take them. But I'm odd.
I do, too. I love them. I do it all day if somebody'd let me.
Yeah.
I wanted to add one other thing about our design, which was we were from the very beginning, I felt really strongly that we need to make sure that we are ensuring as much geographic representativeness and representativeness along urban, suburban, rural dimensions. So the way we started, and I don't want to drag the listeners through all the boring details, and they probably would become boring pretty fast, of how we chose the exact schools, but we started by taking all of the congressional districts, all 435 congressional districts, plus we put D.C. in our list, and we ranked them, we arranged them from most densely populated down to least densely populated. And when we pulled our sample, the very first thing we did is we selected 110 of those 435 congressional districts. And so we picked, I don't know what it would have been, every second or third or whatever, you know, nth one that we picked, and we pulled them off of the list as organized by population density. So I feel good about being able to say that these aren't just all urban teachers, they're not all just rural teachers, they're not all just coastal teachers or Midwestern teachers or Mountain West or whatever. They are from all over the country.
That's good. I'm glad to hear that because of being a rural Westerner, we oftentimes feel we get overlooked out here. So thank you for including some of us folks. Let's get to the results. And we will preface this by saying that this is an ongoing study. It's kind of fun. I asked you what you wanted to talk about, and you're excited about this paper, and I think it's a really relevant topic. But, you know, this is, you're getting some data as it comes in. You're sifting through this. And what are we starting to see?
What we're starting to see in very short form is that political ideology, more than party ID, seems to be driving people's attitudes about this, which I think, about the matters that we analyze, the five matters that that I listed earlier. So being conservative or being liberal plays a much more statistically important role than being a Republican or being a Democrat. And, of course, those two things are highly correlated, but when you put them both in the analysis, typically ideology shows up as being statistically important and party ID less so. And I think it's interesting because when we think about how politically polarized our country is right now, that a lot of that comes through around party ID. But in the case of our results, we are seeing that instead of party ID, that is the political team that you think you belong to, instead of that, what we're seeing is people who are ideologically more conservative are much, much more likely to support the idea that that teachers ought to be able to do whatever they need to do pursuant to religious freedom. Liberals, and this isn't shocking, right? Liberals are more likely to say, nah, I don't know about that. Conservative, and I think part of this is conservatives are picturing in their heads the idea that maybe they perceive Christianity being moved to the margins as our country becomes a little bit more secular, et cetera, and religiously diverse. The other interesting thing, and we'll see if this holds up later on, but when we think about how religion, people, ordinary people's religion, affects how they think about politics, typically we look at three things. We look at religious affiliation, that is, you're United Methodist, or whatever you are. Second thing we look at is how often you do actions, that is, participate in things as a result of religion, like how often you pray, how often you attend worship services, this sort of thing. And the third thing we look at is the orthodoxy of your religious beliefs, that is, how strongly do you hold these beliefs, how sure are you, for example, that God exists or something like that. And what we found in these preliminary analyses is that the first two, and I have to say that the religious affiliation isn't measured well yet, but just in this preliminary kind of way, religious affiliation doesn't seem to matter a whole lot, and frequency of religious participation doesn't matter a whole lot either. What really does matter a whole lot is how strongly held your religious beliefs are. And that makes all kinds of sense, too. The more strongly your religiously held beliefs are, the more strongly you hold your religious beliefs, the more orthodox you are in terms of religiosity, the more likely you are to be supportive of teachers exercising their religious freedom on the job. So that's sort of what we've got at this point, in a very basic kind of way.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that you mentioned here, and that kind of got me thinking, you mentioned that we're, as a society now, very polarized in terms of political partisan affiliation. What do we like, the blue or the red team more than, you know, others? But ideology here seems to be highly correlated to it, but still a little bit out of phase. And as I'm listening to this, I'm almost wondering if, you know, there's the possibility of a partisan realignment around some of these issues, some kind of sifting out of our partisan affiliations based upon ideology that's going on based upon some of these religious liberty issues. Any thoughts on that?
Oh, I think that's absolutely true. I think that we are absolutely beginning to see a partisan realignment. People, and you and I are both, you know, political scientists, and there's this kind of inside baseball matter of some scholars say that every 30 years or so there's what we call a partisan realignment, where some important groups of people, some large groups of people, switch their party ID for some reason or another. And some scholars have been saying, you know, that hasn't happened since FDR. And other scholars have said, well, maybe it sort of happened, you know, between about the late 60s and Ronald Reagan or so. Whether that's true or not, it looks very much to me as though we're starting to see one now, a partisan realignment, in which people who typically, a large group of people who typically historically voted Democratic are now very much voting Republican. And that is white folks, particularly white folks who maybe are not as financially well off as other white folks. And some of this breaks down along urban, suburban, rural as well. The further away you live from an urban area, if you're white and you're maybe not as wealthy, the more likely you are today to be a Republican. And it used to be the opposite, right? Like a state like West Virginia, for example. And a lot of this has to do with the decline of labor unions. But a state like West Virginia used to be very solidly Democratic. Lots of white people, lots of working class white people who were very, very, very loyal Democrats. And now Does Trump have any chance of winning? I'm sorry, does Clinton have any chance of winning West Virginia? Well, no, not at all. The Democrats, to a certain degree, appear to be becoming, for a lot of interesting reasons, the party of more privileged folks and the party of people who are not white, or certainly people who are not, not to say there are no white people who are Democrats. There certainly are. But the people who are white who are Democrats tend to be better off socioeconomically. There's, like I said, an urban-rural-suburban split to this, where urban folks are very clearly very Democratic, and rural folks in the aggregate are very clearly quite Republican. And along with that comes religiosity, right? So, and part of this is just basic sort of dynamics of what one sees in one's everyday life. If you live in New York City, the chances of running into people on a day-to-day basis who are of every faith tradition you can imagine, including none whatsoever, is very high. Right, so you're immersed in a situation where the political context that you observe every day is highly diverse religiously. Whereas in a smaller town, now it's not to say every small town, right, but in a smaller town where there are just simply fewer people to begin with, the odds of running into every religion under the sun on a day-to-day basis in person is lower. So, for that reason, for many other reasons, people in urban areas are more likely than people in rural areas to be either a member of a religious minority group or to be secular, that is, to not practice any religion. And so there ends up being this kind of divide, I think, in a lot of people's minds on both sides, on the part of urban people who look at people in rural areas and might end up thinking of President Obama's, often brought up quote where he said that people in rural areas cling to guns and God, et cetera, and might sort of think about that in a disparaging kind of way, as opposed to rural folks who might think, well, people in big cities are all just a bunch of sinners, right? They're all just a bunch of atheists, or they're members of religious groups that I have no idea what they do or what they look like or why they exist, and I feel a little bit off-put by that. So to the degree that polarization, partisan realignment are connected to A, religion, and B, to the questions that we're asking, I think not only is there a powerful connection across all of that, but the fact that I wanted to make sure that our sample was representative geographically and in terms of urbanicity speaks to that.
Yeah, and now that you talk about this, this kind of puts a little thought in my head, and I get your thoughts on this as well. You mentioned New York City, and it's a place that's filled with a multiplicity of religious faiths, including lots of nuns, people who don't have any religious affiliation or who might go full bore atheist. I'm wondering how your study plays out, and I don't know if you've drilled down to the data enough on this. I could imagine some small segment or small minority religion being very concerned about these issues of free exercise, being able to wear your specific religious garb in school if you're a teacher or a superintendent or even a secretary at the front desk of a high school or something like that. And to what extent that might actually correspond to what some of the folks in the rural area, I mean, rural people are saying, of course you should be able to free exercise maybe and et cetera, et cetera. But they might find some common ground with some of these religious minorities in urban areas. Have you seen anything like that?
Absolutely. I haven't, but I'm going to be able to look at it.
Yeah.
And I think you couldn't possibly be more correct about that. I mean, I think that the common ground, the common ground there is extraordinary. Whether folks realize it, like ordinary people on the ground who might share that common ground, I don't know that they realize it, but I think it's there. Just from looking through a little bit of the data in a case-by-case way, which I had to do for some reason or another not too long ago, there are some folks in there who are not Christian, not Jewish, and not secular. So there's going to be, I mean, I don't know if there's going to be lots and lots of teachers who are Muslim or Sikh or Buddhist or Hindu or anything non-Christian other than Jewish. But to the degree that there are, we're going to be able to look at them and see if their attitudes toward religious freedom are any different in a systematic way than those of, say, Christians. And could we compare them in urban areas to, let's say, Protestants in rural areas and see if that common ground is there? Absolutely, yes, we could.
Yeah. I'm just thinking back to the Smith v. Employment Division of Oregon case that
yep.
created this bizarre coalition of people from hardcore fundamentalist evangelicals to people wanting to smoke peyote to, you know, you name it, was in this coalition. And I'm like, yeah, there's a lot of common ground there. And this might be shifting a lot of things politically. And just fascinating to see that you are gathering some of this data that might help us figure that out a little bit more.
Thank you so much. We're so excited about it.
Yeah, no, it is cool. One question I have before I get, you know, have you speculate a little bit on the upcoming election and how it relates mm-hmm. to previous elections. Just a top line analysis. That one question you thought that was very interesting, which I did too. The unnamed official question. You know, mm-hmm. if unnamed official said this and did this, what kind of top line support was it? Was it a 50-50 split, 70-30? What do we see?
The question reads, to what degree do you support a government official who refuses to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples after the U.S. Supreme Court's decision that such couples have a right to marry? And in the preliminary data, we have 1,823 people answering. 10.2% said they would strongly support this person. 13.6% said they'd support, so that's 23 about a quarter would support or strongly support. 26.5% say oppose, so another quarter there, and almost half, 49.8%, said they would strongly oppose that person.
Hmm.
So half strongly oppose and half something else.
Yeah. Well, very interesting, because that kind of it gives you an idea of teachers being put into that position. What would they do? And so it seems that a lot of people would be kind of froggy being put into that position.
Yes.
In some ways or another. Very cool. So let me now go ahead and turn to the upcoming election, but perhaps put this into context of elections over the past, 20 or 30 years. You've done a lot of work, written a lot of books, worked with a lot of people. In fact, I think you're responsible for surveying South Carolina and some of your previous work to find out what religious folks are thinking about when it comes to national elections. And what are we finding here? Because this election that we're entering into November of 2016 looks like a very interesting one. And I should note that we are recording this here on September 12th. So in case anything weird happens in the next few days before it airs, you're not responsible for that. But, you know, this is one of these elections that, I don't know, when Bush was elected, a lot of talk about evangelicals there. Even when President Obama was up against Mitt Romney, religion played a big issue here. But, you know, now we have two candidates that, I don't know, religion doesn't seem to factor in any of this. Is this a different election, or are we seeing some similar trends over the past 20 years?
It's both, actually.
A great social science answer. Yeah.
It's both. So in a nutshell, since roughly 1980, a few factors have been incredibly important in terms of religion, religion as it affects an individual, and vote choice. And those factors are evangelical Protestants have tended to be extremely Republican. Catholics have tended to be a swing constituency, as have mainline Protestants. And folks who are African-American Protestant or Jewish or non-Christian or nothing at all have tended to be pretty Democratic. Separately, the more you are active in religious life and the more deeply held your religious beliefs are, the more Republican you are. So So those two basics in mind. What we're seeing is interesting, really. What we're seeing in the data that I've looked at would be several things. One, Trump is just as likely to get votes from evangelical Protestants in the fall as Mitt Romney was. A lot of that, though, and the Pew Forum has, the Pew Research Center has some interesting data on this. A lot of that among evangelicals is driven less by excitement about Trump than by dislike of Hillary Clinton. So, to a degree, Trump is the beneficiary of who the Democratic nominee is in this case, and she's somebody who is as disliked in the aggregate as Trump himself is. So Trump, you know, hangs on to evangelical voters, maybe not a sizable percentage of them, not necessarily because he is to any degree a natural spokesperson for that constituency, and he isn't, except insofar as he's politically conservative on some issues, but more because evangelicals really just plain don't like Hillary Clinton. Mainline Protestants seem to be sort of split with a lot of indecisiveness. I would think that because mainline Protestants, even today, tend to be a little bit better off socioeconomically than non-mainline Protestants, that Hillary Clinton probably ends up with a bare majority of mainline Protestant votes. One other thing that we're seeing is tremendous support for Clinton among people who have no religious affiliation, and there's nothing new there. The only thing in terms of religious affiliation that I'm seeing and sort of sensing is that Catholics, and you can never talk about the Catholic vote any more than you can talk about the women's vote, and honestly, any more than you can talk about the evangelical vote, right? Because everybody's different. But Catholics are such a swing constituency. They're such a diverse constituency. They appear to be favoring Clinton to a little bit higher degree than they did Obama. And I would think, you know, what's that about? Well, what it's really about is that the Catholic population in the United States is becoming increasingly, not majority by any means, but increasingly Hispanic. And Hispanic Catholics are very, very much in favor of Hillary Clinton. And that's something I've been thinking about for a long time for the Democratic Party, is if the Democrats can, for a long period of time, get Hispanic Catholics to be part of their constituency, that ends up paying all kinds of dividends for generations to come. And Trump's rhetoric on immigration is only helping Hillary in that regard, among most, but certainly not all, the Hispanic Catholics. So that, you know, they, for the most part, it's the same with a little bit of, you know, maybe Catholic voters in the aggregate look a little bit more Democratic, but that isn't about Trump or Hillary as much as it is the growing size of the Hispanic component of that coalition, of that demographic, I should say. What's interesting, though, and what is different than what we typically would see is, and we'll see if this holds up in November, but some data I saw, and just kind of talking to students and being out in the world, it seems to me that the very powerful relationship between religious participation and vote for the Republican candidate is not holding up like it usually does. That is to say, there are many more church-going people, if you want to call them that, worship-attending people, devout people in terms of practice, who are either not wanting to vote for Trump or wanting to vote for Hillary Clinton or just simply saying, I don't really know what I'm going to do in the fall yet. One illustration of this that keeps coming to mind is the Mormon hesitance that I've sensed to support Trump. That's kind of been a theme ever since last spring. you know, Mormon folks, most Mormon folks are very good about attending services, very good about participating in things that are required of them as a result of their faith, and would rank pretty high on any measure of, in the aggregate, rank pretty high on any measure of religious participation. And that group is, I mean, Utah will end up going for Trump in the end. Yeah, probably, but not by the kinds of percentage margins that we typically would see. So there's something about Trump that seems to be causing people for whom religious participation is incredibly important to hesitate some.
Interesting stuff to be watching for and see if there are these alignments and changes in the patterns that we have been observing over the past 20, 30, or even 40 years here. So things we'll look for. We'll have to get you back on the podcast again to possibly talk about this stuff. One other final question that I have, and you mentioned this early on in the podcast, that you and Suzanne are in the same fantasy football league, and you're a knowledgeable statistician and stuff. Who's your number one fantasy quarterback?
Well, I've got to tell you, on one of my two teams, it's Russell Wilson, and he's hurt.
Yeah. So he plays through the hurt.
He plays through the hurt. Bless his heart. Yeah, but I'm nervous about him. I have Carson Wentz as a backup to him, though, on the Eagles. So if poor Russell is very hurt, then, you know, maybe Carson Wentz is the real deal and I can throw him out there every week. But I have to say, I mean, my heart is always with Aaron Rodgers because I'm from Wisconsin and I'm a Packer fan.
Yeah.
So
I'm originally from Wisconsin, but I'm a Seahawks fan, and I'm a Cam Newton guy, though. All my leagues this year.
Oh, I love him, too.
I know. He's like, I have a man crush on Cam Newton because he has so much fun playing, and he's from Carolina. So it's interesting that you have, for being out there in the Carolina region, you're obviously South Carolina, not North Carolina, but, you know, you're close.
It's super close. Yeah.
Yeah. You have my quarterback out here, Russell Wilson, and I have your quarterback out there. So
I know.
Anyways, but I want to thank Laura Olson for being on our podcast. Laura, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you so much, Tony. I enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.